Hello and welcome to a new How Did You Make It? The podcast in which we explore each step that has built the career path of various individuals through the discovery of the habits, passions, interests over the last few decades. I'm Yusra, your host, and today we meet Faz. I'm not going to tell you too much, but Faz tells you how you should approach your uni days, and what I'm sure you will take out of this episode is the drive to build your own path through commitment and to build your own community that aligns with your true self. As a high achiever, he embodies curiosity, innovation, and drive. Let's learn from him. Hi, Faz. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you with us today. Well, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thank you for having me on the podcast, Yusra. My name is Faz. By day, I am a humble civil servant, but by night, I do all sorts of interesting things, hopefully. Despite my unwillingness to do these, I somehow end up organizing all sorts of different events for different clubs, for different organizations, for different companies even. I like to build stuff, so whether it's products, apps, things like that. And I just like to talk with lots of interesting people. So I go to lots of different events. I do one too many socializing activities, and generally bit of an extrovert, I might say. So that's me in a nutshell.
I do confirm you were quite the leader in building communities in sports during your time in Dublin, and I highly appreciated that, by the way. I cannot wait to discuss this further when you start building communities and becoming so active outside or within your main responsibilities as a student and such. First, can you tell us your definition of success?
Yeah, it's a very deep question. I think I love this question because I'm going to answer it with another question, which is, when I think about success, I don't ask what I want. I ask myself why I want it. Because in my mind, it's not just about having flashy things, you know, lots of money, big mansion, children, and et cetera, et cetera. It's about asking myself what things will bring me fulfillment, what things will make me content, and what things will drive, you know, high impact and make my life better, as well as people around me better as well. So if I'm doing something that enables a new skill, it helps a community, or it brings fulfillment and contentment to me, then that is success in my mind.
Did you hear that? You already have takeaways here. If you're not sure what your definition of success is, what will bring you fulfillment? What would make you content? What would drive high impact? First, do you think that this reflection, this definition of success, was there when you were still in high school, or did it come at a later stage?
Absolutely later stage. When I was younger, it was all about, you know, what is the most, like, I would go on Google and I would search, which job pays the highest amount? That's the kind of searching I was doing when I was younger. But now in my, you know, as I've grown older a bit, beginning to get some white hairs, you know, even in my 20s now, I'm asking myself more difficult questions, which is, well, why do you want that particular thing? You know, why does it matter to you so much? Is there something else that is more valuable? And I think when you add different, like when you look for different things beyond, say, just monetary or beyond just, you know, obvious satisfactory things, then the question becomes a lot more interesting. So for me, yeah, it's definitely a much, much more recent thing where I've asked myself, you know, why are you doing what you're doing? Is this something that you, like, is this something that your younger self would be proud of? Is this something that your future self would be happy that you're doing? Those are the kind of questions I'm asking myself now. So it's a very much a new thing that I'm looking into.
Those are fantastic questions. Is this something your younger self would be proud of and that your future self would be happy that you're doing? I think those questions are very interesting as well because we change so much throughout life. Asking yourself those questions will help you so much when you're lost, unsure of which choice or decision to make. Well, let's now talk about your early teenage years, middle school years, when you were 12, 13. What kind of student were you? What were your habits, passions, anything that you can share with us?
Mm-hmm. So when I was 12 and 13, that would be year 8 and year 9, I believe, in the British education system. And so in when I was in year eight, I was going to a preparatory school, which is a school that is designed to essentially prepare you for life and prepare you for kind of a particular life path. Whereas in when I was 13, I went to a classical state school. So for me, those kind of early teenager years were really interesting to me because the first school that I went to there was, it was a very posh, it was based in Oxford. So it was a very, very posh place. And the kinds of things that they kind of taught you weren't just the subjects that they were kind of teaching you as they would, but it was also explaining etiquette, which is a very weird and interesting thing when you're particularly at that age in your formative years. So I'll give a fantastic example here, which is, you know, there was a day where I forgot to, you know, put my homework in the edge of the classroom where we were supposed to, you know, place it every single morning. And for some reason I forgot to do that. And I was panicking all of a sudden because, oh my God, you know, my homework isn't going to be there. And so, you know, I rush upstairs again, you know, during lunchtime, trying to put my textbook there. And I see the entire stack of papers is gone. So I realize that, oh my gosh, my teacher's taken it. So I run downstairs at lunchtime and I find and this class was taught by the headmaster as well. So it wasn't just any typical teacher. So I run downstairs, find the headmaster eating lunch. And I approach him and say, I'm really sorry. I completely forgot to, you know, place my workbook in the corner of the classroom, but I have it here now. I didn't just do it now. I did it last night, et cetera, et cetera. And he looks at me and he says, I can give you two responses. Do you want the polite answer or do you want the honest answer? And I'm 12 years old here. I have no idea what this means. And so I say, can I have the polite answer, please? And he says, thank you very much. I'll get it marked for you by the next lesson. And that was it. And I just ran away. Obviously, now I kind of know what he would have said if I said honest answer, obviously. But that was kind of although it wasn't a piece of advice or anything, it was just an interesting experience to me because it explained to me that sometimes giving your honest opinion isn't always the best thing to do. Sometimes you need to be charming and flattering at times rather than trying to be the know-it-all person there or trying to express the opinion for the sake of it or whatever. So I think that's kind of the vibe that was given to me when I was in kind of year eight at age 12, 13, that kind of kind of time period. Then you move over to the state school side of stuff, which is a very interesting dynamic because now all of a sudden you're in an area where things are a lot more effectively rough, shall I say. Things are a lot more unfiltered and there isn't really anything that, you know, is unexpected at that point. Whereas in a more kind of formalized preparatory school zone, things are a lot more specific, a lot more tailored, a lot more structured in comparison. And so that was very interesting to me because it was a new city, it was a new school, it was very interesting people there, interesting characters. So for me, having that dual experience was, I think, really important to understand because I understood how a particular type of person would interact with the world. You would probably call them posh or middle class or whatever. But you also had, you know, the masses, essentially, you know, everyone from, and you had all types of people from, you know, working class, middle class, even, you know, upper class there as well at times. So this was a very diverse experience when it came to the state school place, essentially. So that's kind of my experience at that age where you have these two different worlds and I'm kind of being thrusted into both of them in a very short period of time.
This is very interesting. Thanks, Fez. I do have a recommendation then for you who are listening to us, is to ask yourself the following question. Should you be a charming version of yourself or is it time for you to share your true opinion on a subject? Is trying to test and understand your environment, trying to, as we say, to read the room, like when is it time for you to actually be persistent, asking questions, being a little bit bold, and when it's time to just lay back. In fact, how are you as a student? What about your favorite classes or least favorite classes?
As a student, I was very much average, I'll be honest. I think a lot of people, you know, if you were to ask me what set I was in, I would say middle set or maybe middle upper set or something like that. So, you know, my maths was a bit stronger. My science was a bit stronger than my English. But I think for me, it was just a matter of you know, I show up, I do the homework, I don't get into trouble, I freeze my hand and job done. There you have it. So that's kind of the extent of it. I wasn't doing any prodigy work. I wasn't, you know, leader of the chess club or anything like that. So my schooling was quite, not generic, but it was quite predictable in that sense, because there wasn't anything shocking or anything that was, you know, out of the ordinary in that sense. What is interesting is, as a child, I've had to wear glasses, and so my eyesight has always been much weaker. And while I can see things, you know, fine, you know, it's not that bad. But historically, I've always had the need to, you know, rely on the sense of touch, essentially, rather than using my eyes. So maybe that's why I preferred science and maths over English, because I don't have to read too much. But that's probably where that interest likely stems from. But for me, it was always just numbers, building stuff, whether it's design technology or whether it was science and you know, computer science and things like that.
And do you think your interest was only due to personal reasons, the one you just mentioned, or did you have fascinating teachers, or was it a mix of both?
I think it's a bit of both. I think as a child, you know, I was a big fan of Lego, and Lego is one of those classical toys where anybody from any background can pick it up. It's not supposed to be gendered. It's not supposed to be specific to any particular genre. I know that things have changed a bit now, but it really, you know, in my childhood, you would pick up the bricks, you would build a set, but then once you build a set, you can do whatever you want with it. Well, you know, and I think my favorite sets back then were something called Lego Mars Mission sets. So they were all about, you know, exploring the world, exploring space, exploring aliens and things like that. And I think that has a very direct interest to science and the STEM subjects inherently. So there was definitely that link I can think of. So regarding teachers, I think the main thing there was science, and particularly chemistry, had lots of interesting experiments. And if you're a 12, 13-year-old child, you're going to say, wow, look at this. I mean, a classic experiment I can remember is the applying heat to a strip of magnesium. And when you do that against a Bunsen burner, it would generate a very bright light to the point where we were told not to look directly at it to avoid, you know, having, you know, temporary blindness or anything like that. And we're 12, 13-year-old children. I don't know what they were doing, to be honest. But, you know, they're saying, you know, look to the side of it, just get an understanding of what's there. We'll take a video of it as well so you can see what it looks like in a safer environment. It's things like that which are far more inspirational, because you get to see some really exciting things, whether it's blowing up, whether it's sparkling away, whether it's some popping or things like that. Another great example would be, you know, the teacher would, you know, produce some kind of hydrogen gas, and then she would get a match, light it, and pop, boom, fire comes out of it, or pops and makes a very large popping sound. That again, just, you know, as a child, it inspires, you know, crazy things like, oh my God, this is crazy, you know, let's do that again, do that again and again. So for me, science was a lot more interesting as an exciting in terms of the experiment, in terms of the content, and an understanding, well, why is this the case? You know, it's all well and good saying, okay, yeah, you know, fire plus hydrogen equals popping sounds, but why is that the case? And then you kind of get into the science behind it. You look at things like, you know, your electrons, your protons. I probably have some chemists screaming at me right now with that, but that's kind of where that inspiration starts from. So definitely experiments, definitely some childhood games and things like that. I think also, you know, computers were just coming around, were getting in popularity. So I'm not that old, but, you know, I do remember a time before I was like, I wasn't a child on the internet all day long or anything like that. You know, I did play a video game, but also went outside at the same time. I had a good proportion of this. So I think that again, you know, it encourages you to, you know, think about what exists on this virtual plane, essentially. So you've got, you know, you've got going outside with your friends and the bikes and everything, but also you've got these crazy big screens and devices that you're looking at and saying, hey, you know, what can I do with this? And that itself is also really cool, because then you have to like do everything from little things like moving a mouse, keyboard, you know, downloading stuff. And there's a huge amounts of downloaded music, of course, as we all did, things like that. So all these different things where you have experiments, where you have introduction to new technology, to you know, to general kind of toys and interests, all of these linked together to kind of pushing towards science and STEM related subject areas. Teachers were inspirational, I suppose. I had good teachers. They listened. They were very, very good. But it really was the experiments that were the cherry on top.
And were you working hard to study those 10 classes? What did you do to understand what was expected from you?
Yeah, I think not just with STEM, with all learning, I think I'm much more of a hands-on person. So if you were to, I rarely learn things from podcasts, whereas I will learn from, you know, writing a blog a lot more. So that's kind of the way I've learned about things. It's by actually trying it myself and actually attempting to do it myself. I get a much better insights into how stuff works. I find, you know, watching videos or reading books, while it's interesting and some of it does stick, I think the most effective form for learning, at least for myself, is just trying it yourself and trying to get your hands dirty, essentially. I think in terms of the type of student I was, I mean, you know, I think there are kind of two parts of this. So there was the schoolwork, which I was a good student in the sense of I did all my homework on time. I'd submitted it. I didn't get into detention. I was a good boy. You know, I didn't do anything like that. But, you know, was I coming consistently top of the class? No. Was I receiving, you know, accolades and awards and things like that when I was at school? Also, no. I think for me, it was, put it this way. When I was in year seven and year eight.
So when you were 12, 13.
We used to receive report cards every single term. And there were two columns in these report cards. There was the attainment column and there was the effort column. And my dad used to say to me, as long as your effort column is top marks, all A's, he's satisfied. Doesn't matter what the attainment is. As long as you tried your best, then he's satisfied with whatever the attainment is. And if there is a really bad score there, then yeah, we can look into things like tutoring, maybe some extra homework, maybe some, you know, extra classes, things like that, to see why don't you get it despite the fact that you're trying. So my efforts were persistently high, with these, you know, almost always A grades with the occasional B. The attainments were kind of mixed everywhere from kind of A to kind of B and maybe some C's as well here and there. So it was a bit of a mix in that sense. But I think for me, it was about, you know, are you trying hard to get things done? And if you're not, then clearly you don't get it. Or clearly this learning style isn't working for you specifically. So that's kind of how things were back then.
What you're highlighting is so important. You need to figure out what works best for you, for your own studying approach strategy, if you can call it like this. Whether it is listening to podcasts, watching YouTube videos and taking notes, reading your course again and again and again, asking questions to your teacher, but consistently practicing is a non-negotiable. And this will help you get to the next level wherever you are right now.
So, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's something which is very specific about trying something yourself, where if you observe somebody else, if you look at somebody else doing something, then you will get some insight into what they're doing. But when you try something yourself, you will have to do every single small activity, every single tiny little thing that has to go into a piece of work, or whether it's homework, whether it's production of art or whatever. You have to know every single piece, everything from knowing where to stand, how to hold your hands, you know, how many times you have to, you know, screw in a screw, and how many times you have to tighten it, what the material feels like, you know, all your little things add up to the overall experience. And you can't get that from reading a book. You can't get that from just observing somebody. You have to do it yourself. And I think that's why, for me, learning by doing something was always more effective than observing stuff. I know there are people out there who are brilliantly smart, who can just look at something and just understand it immediately. But for me, it was really just, if I really want to appreciate the depth of it, then I have to try it myself. And I think if somebody's struggling with something, then, you know, then try to do it yourself, essentially. You know, if you're something as simple as saying, let's say you're playing a video game and you can't get past a certain level, well, okay, in that situation, you might go and, you know, watch a walkthrough and then understand what to do. But when you go back to the game, you still have to do it yourself. You still have to appreciate all the little tiny micro movements that somebody might make on the controller or on the keyboard to get to that result. And so you can learn from visual, from reading and things like that. But to get the full exposure, you have to try it yourself.
I couldn't agree more. And the video game analogy is a fantastic example for our gamers out there who are not yet reconciled with practicing after class hours. So something you mentioned, which is super important as well to remember, by doing, you will also realize which area, classes you prefer. And if it remains challenging, it does not mean that you won't succeed or you're not good at it. It could certainly mean, though, that it requires some adjustments and that more practice could help you get to the level you aspire to, what is the next level, or a decent one. Faz, I do have a last question on your early teenage years. As I know you are big in sports, were you practicing any other time?
Oh, I love sports. I love sports. I think at the time, not as much. So, you know, we have physical education classes as part of the British curriculum. So I would play rugby, football, rounders, do cross-country runs, things like that. Hate cross-country runs. But hey, I enjoyed, in hindsight, I enjoyed rugby, I suppose. Football I enjoyed, rounders I enjoyed, and all the different racket sports as well. I think I was quite a short child, and I'm taller now, but I was quite, relatively speaking, my growth spurt was a lot later. So for me, you know, a lot of these sports were, you know, obviously physically demanding. You're surrounded by much taller, stronger boys. And so you do get a bit ruffled around here and there, which is, you know, it's part of the game, part of the fun, I suppose. But it wasn't something that I was that good and too keen at the time. Fast forward to today, love sports, regularly play squash, cycle all the time, love badminton. If someone, you know, plays football with me, I'll happily join and things like that. So I'm definitely a lot more into sports today than I was back then, but that's probably just because I have glasses, I probably couldn't see the ball too well. Wasn't as big as the other people there. So, you know, Wally wasn't that good at rugby in that sense, although I was fast enough to get around people. And I suppose I found my calling with, you know, racket sports and things like that, where it's much more controlled, it's much more specific, and much more, it's very specific skills, very bespoke in that sense.
And sports teach you so much, from team spirit, resilience, pushing yourself, trusting yourself, believing in yourself, and having fun. So to wrap up on your early teenage years, do you have any advice beyond everything you already shared so far?
You have to always keep trying. If you stop trying, you stop learning. And if you stop learning, you stop progressing. And the one thing that every single teenager should know is that you are in your formative years. There is so many years ahead. You might think that high school was the worst thing in the world. You know, you hate it, et cetera, et cetera. You hate your teachers, you hate your classmates, you hate the homework, et cetera. But actually, just try and put a bit of effort into it, because when you 5 years later, 10 years later, it might seem ages away. But actually, now that I'm here in that situation, it felt like literally decades ago now. So, always try, or keep trying and trying and trying. I think the other thing I'd say here is, failure is okay. I think people often get terrified at, you know, failure. And I think when we're teenagers, failure to us is like getting an F on a paper, or getting 0%, or, you know, not doing well in a school test. And yes, it's important, you should study and everything, but actually you learn more from the things that are wrong and from the things that are right on your marking sheet. And so just because you do badly in something doesn't mean that you're incapable. It just means that in that moment in time, you maybe weren't there. But now that you know what's wrong, you can now improve. And then maybe the second time you do it, you'll be much better. Just try this. You know, do an exam paper. The first time you might do okay on average or whatever. Do the exact same paper again, and you'll do way better. And you know how to apply it in a better way now. So the more you try something, the better you get at it, and the better you get at it, the more confident you'll feel about these things. So you should never ever stop trying. You should never ever stop learning about these things. That's my advice.
Keep trying. And failure is more than okay. And I think if you keep both of them in your head, you will be able to reach your potential, what you're actually able to do. Thanks, Faz. That's incredibly helpful. Can you now tell us a little bit more about your high school years, so late teenage years, 15 to 18, I would say? What did those years teach you? What kind of student were you? Did you know what you wanted to do after those years? Were you still interested in STEM, so moved more towards humanities, which covers more literature, history, philosophy, and arts?
So when I was younger, the ambition was to become a nuclear physicist. I don't know, I don't really remember why there was such an obsession with this, but I suppose, you know, that I did enjoy history as well. That's one of the few humanities that I did actually enjoy quite a lot alongside STEM. So maybe it was just this fascination of like STEM in you know, war and history and big events like that. So I think for whatever reason, I was quite obsessed with becoming a nuclear physicist of some kind. Obviously, that didn't turn out to be the case. Can't read that. I don't know physics particularly well. Maths is fine, but physics is not so great. So that plan obviously was crap. But I think STEM was kind of my go-to from, you know, throughout primary and then early secondary school, and then towards the kind of middle part of secondary school and towards the later stage, it kind of moved more towards humanities and social sciences. So mostly because the maths got more difficult, mostly because the things, I just didn't understand it as well. And humanities just made a bit more sense in terms of, it was more practical to me as well. So obviously physics and maths, I have a passion for it, I'm very interested in it, but I'm more of a amateur enthusiast of it rather than being an academic or being very deep and studying it properly in the conventional sense. And obviously over time I kind of moved towards more business and economic related stuff over time. So I think the key difference here is that, you know, STEM tends to have this characterization of being right or wrong. You know, 1 + 1 = 2, it can't be anything else. You know, this particle does this, and you know, that's how the world works. So you know, accept it or don't accept it, but that's what happens. So there's very, very hard specific lines around what is and isn't true, what isn't right in STEM, whereas in humanities things are far more subjective. And so typically the subjectivity comes from people, because humanities are talking about, you know, people interacting with other people, essentially. So, you know, you take something like history. Well, what is history? Well, history is just people interacting with other people and then doing stupid things and then leading to all sorts of weird events. Take business or economics. Again, this is just people interacting with each other. One is for, you know, trade. One is for, you know, starting a business or something like that. And so this movement from trying to know what is right and wrong in definitive terms, like in maths and science, moving over to humanities, where you actually have this people component to it, and saying, actually, what should the price of eggs be? Well, who knows? Who knows? It can be £5, €5. It could be 10. It could be 2. You know, pick whichever one you want, and that becomes a lot more interesting. So for me, there was always this link towards at least particularly maths, but it became more of a people-oriented thing. So why are we using maths? How are we using maths? People use maths. Not maths isn't there for the sake of it. We're using maths to do things with it. So what is that, and how can I learn more about it?
People use math, and you are trying to understand the dynamics around it is so interesting, and it explains also your higher degree orientation after high school. First, how did you make the shift from wanting to become a nuclear physicist? And I'm curious to understand what other elements outside of school or within school impacted your choice?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I think this comes from video games. Mm-hmm. So I was a massive Minecraft fanatic. I loved the game so much. I played it every single day. I remember when it came out in alpha mode. So I had it really early on. And Minecraft is an interesting game because it is very mathsy in the sense of you have 64 stacks of blocks. You've got you know, you have a certain number of steps. Every single block is 1 meter by 1 meter or whatever. So there's a lot of numbers involved, but it is fundamentally a social game. You are building a world. You may be playing in multiplayer with other players and things like that. And that's where you kind of have this transition from being a purely, I must get X number of or 64 number of blocks or whatever, to, you know, I'm gonna build something, I'm gonna build a house and a base with my friends now. So you have this link between numbers and STEM and kind of moving towards a more social element of these sorts of things. So I think that's definitely probably how it kind of moved over, just from a social element. I think on top of that, I watched a lot of YouTube as well when I was back then, and a lot of kind of mini documentaries and a lot of kind of interesting channels were out there. Not new channels, but kind of infographic new channels that are quite abundant nowadays. The classic ones like Wendover Productions, Vox. I think they weren't there at the time, but there were similar types of channels back then. Those were really interesting to me because they promoted themselves as being these very objective, scientific videos, when actually they were very subjective in terms of what the topic was. So, you know, a topic would be something like, you know, how do you build the biggest plane or something like that? Well, okay, you know, that's interesting. It's an engineering video or whatever, but you know, there's a lot of subjectivity around that because you can always build a bigger plane, or you know, maybe this is the biggest plane by this company or by this or this type. And so, you know, it became a lot more, I think the storytelling aspect of it became a lot more interesting to me. So that's how that transition went from kind of core STEM and kind of going, you know, numbers, science, and things like that, moving into that kind of social element of it behind the scenes, saying, you know, well, why are we, you know, how does this stuff even come out to be? Who discovered this? Why did they discover it? Why were they looking into this, etc.? And then you kind of use that and to move on into more social science-y stuff down the line.
So the numbers and the social aspect of the game, whose parents could have guessed the impact on your major thanks to video games? And from what you're saying, you have been highly curious since your early teenage years. Do you know how come? You are questioning yourself. I'm sure most kids are just playing Minecraft. They did not connect the dots at the time. How does someone become curious? How did you?
I think it's probably the Lego. It's probably the Lego. I mean, it's one of those toys where, you know, your imagination is really what drives it. So you can build anything. And the thing is, you can have a bunch of Lego as a child. You can build something really, really ugly, but it doesn't matter because what the imagination is of the child. So if I use three blocks to build a plane, that's a plane in my mind. It might look like three blocks to you, but it's a plane to me. It's got all the details of the plane in my mind, at least, where it's got the engines, it's got the rudder, it's got the wings, it's got the cockpit, it's got all the different things. So I think that as an essence, you know, in a physical world, Lego is probably the most imaginative tool out there. So, you know, maybe they could sponsor the podcast or something like that. But that's kind of how I see it. And then you have other kind of sandbox games. So these are things like Minecraft and other games where you have to just express yourself in whatever way you want. So yeah, you have some specific things that you have some specific missions you have to do here and there, but really, it really is your world that you can do whatever you want in. And that is it's both terrifying and it's completely freeing at the same time, because now all of a sudden you can build whatever you want, you can do whatever you want, and there's no restriction, no time restriction, no resource restriction, nothing that can stop you from doing whatever you want. So I think those kinds of games and those kinds of activities is, I think, what is probably the root of this, of the curiosity and inspiration of that. So that's where it probably starts. I think the other part of it is, I think my upbringing was also very positive in that sense, where, you know, we were always taught to think, always taught to understand, not just, we weren't told to do things. We were also asked to think about why we're doing this as well. So that again is a part of the curiosity aspect, because it's not just a matter of, well, you should be good. Well, why should I be good? Well, you know, because it's nice, because it's kind to people. You want to promote good things across the community. You want to, be respectful. You want to build a community around it that is more positive, and it feels good to yourself as well. You know, all these things and so many more. So those are the kind of places where I think you get curiosity coming from. You have the games from childhood, you have types of things you're doing with. And I think most importantly, just talking with people as well. You know, every single person has a fascinating story behind them. And the more you interact with people, the more curious you become, because you learn more about different experiences, you learn more about different people, and that goes on.
Call to action here to parents and to the younger generation. First, play video games like Minecraft. You will not only develop a strategic and creative mind, you'll also develop your curiosity. And the second thing is to be supportive and stimulate that curious mind. Surroundings and upbringings can play a big role. And
yeah, it's a combination of all the little things that have combined together to become more curious as a person, I suppose.
And do you remember an advice you received at the time, or do you have an advice yourself looking back?
It's a good question. You know, you live in reality. You don't live online. As much as they may not see a separation between the two, there is separation, and we need to understand this. And so, you know, the internet is a beautiful thing if you use it properly. But I feel that, you know, they haven't been taught the proper etiquettes and proper ways of using it in the way that's most effective to them. So my advice to any high school student is find a project or interest and just go all in on it and just see what happens. Doesn't have to be anything overly complex, but if you just do a series of small, interesting projects, that can be a really, really good use of your time. One of the reasons why I like Lego so much is the fact that you have to build something, and then you complete it, and then you start again. You build something else. And in a way, thinking back, they're kind of mini projects on their own right, just on your own terms, really, because you are building something tangible out of it. And so find something that is bothering you and try to come up with something that would fix it. I mean, a good example of this could be something like, you know, you might have, if you're into computers or computer science, you know, you could, for example, get, lights, fairy lights or whatever, around your room and try to create a program that, you know, the lights change based on the weather outside. So if it's raining, you know, they change to blue. If it's sunny, change to yellow, something like that. And there's loads of existing, code out there that can support that development. It's not a brand new thing, but it's just the fact of being able to write the code, write the program, install the lights and everything, all in little tasks, they add up and they generate a valuable skill. And the younger you do this, the better. So that's an example of, you know, a nice fun little project that, you know, makes your room look nicer. You gain a few skills in terms of coding. And if you like it enough, you know, you might do more of this kind of stuff. And if you hate it, fine, that's okay. You know, at least you know now. I think doing more physical things as well, you know, and not just like sports, but also arts and crafts, you know. Not finger painting, obviously, but, you know, painting itself, writing with a pen and paper specifically, not just typing on the keyboard. These might seem quite old-fashioned traditional things, but actually they develop little things like motor neuron skills when you're in your hands. So you become much, much better at using your hands properly. There's something about, you know, touching paper when you're painting something, which is something much more, you know, spiritual, much more impactful than, say, just drawing something on an iPad, at least in my view. So start to connect more with the physical world rather than being obsessed with things online, because this is actually, I think, part of the problem that a lot of young people are facing, and to no fault of their own, by the way. I think they just pushed onto this. So I'm not having a dig at the young people themselves. I think, you know, I would probably do the same. If I had a phone at 11 or 12, I'd probably do the same, to be honest. So, you know, go outside, you know, experience the world for what it is, and breathe in, breathe out.
Those are brilliant advice, Faz, and there are so many takeaways. I'll just highlight two now. And to quote you first, try to find something that is bothering you and go fix it. And I think it's a brilliant call to action and fantastic mindset to have from as early as you can, basically. And from as early as you can, using the tools and countless access we have, find what sparks interest, passion, and move from being at the mercy of scrolling and trying to leverage those tools to make your life more interesting, more exciting. And the second point is doing more physical things, writing, sports, painting, develop and create that constant balance between working on different projects as well as developing your physical and mental strengths and capabilities. The combination of both, and I will repeat that in every single episode that I'm doing, is it will give you a chance to learn, to try, to fail, and grow. And at the end of the day, it will also allow you to understand what works for you, how capable you are, and what animates you.
I've got a couple other things as well there, actually. So there are little things that you can do, just probably in your local community. So volunteering at a local charity shop is a really interesting experience. I wouldn't do it as a job necessarily. I mean, you can do it as a job and get some money for it as well. But you know, if you're just volunteering, you might have to do things which are completely that suck a lot, to be honest. But I actually think that's actually where you grow the most. So, you know, are you stacking shelves, for example? Are you manning the till? Are you making purchases and helping customers buy and trade things? Are you in the stock room, you know, checking things and ticking things off? These are boring tasks. I fully accept this, but when you do them yourself, you appreciate the world around you a bit more, and you understand what responsibility means, and you can't really fake it as much. Whereas if you were to try and do your thing entirely by your own, you're doing it in an unstructured fashion, which I think is quite difficult for young people to get into, because you're in school day long, you have, you know, 8 a.m. start, 9 a.m. start, you finish at 3 p.m., 4 p.m. or whatever. And so you have this very, very big structure attached to you. And so trying to do something independently entirely on your own can be quite difficult at times. So maybe look at, you know, doing some volunteering on the side, can be a pay job as well, you know, could be helping, you know, if your parents have another business, maybe help out there as well if you don't already. Or even something as simple as, you know, going around to your neighbors and offering them tea, you know, making them tea, or, you know, or doing a charity run or something like that. I think these are little things that you can do just to separate, again, get out of the house, do something that's actually impactful for the community, and just add a bit of variety into your life.
This is a brilliant addition and advice. You learn so much from those experiences, and we are still talking about the early teenagers, so in most countries, you're not allowed to actually properly work. So getting this volunteering experience will not only allow you to be exposed to new skill set, knowledge, understanding of the world, of the expectation of a working environment, even if it's fully volunteering. And giving back is one of the best experiences you can have. Learning how to help your own community, your local community, or wider communities, I think, is absolutely life-changing. I think it also allows you to interact with another generation, so people from outside as well, from your close circle, so you will learn from them. It will be very enriching. And also, you mentioned it earlier, it will allow you to become more curious, trying to understand more of what's happening around you and outside of the school doors and your home. Let's now discuss your undergrad. You explained us why business and economics were of interest to you. Were your teachers inspiring? Did you ever think about changing your major, your path? What did you like the most about that curriculum? And tell us a little bit more about that experience.
So when I was in year 10 and year 11, so doing my GCSEs, it was a requirement at my school that every single student would do business GCSE.
Mm-hmm. A little bit more what it is.
So business GCSE, this is just looking at, this is a general certificate for secondary education. And this is the first major exam that a student in the UK will do. And my school, and normally schools in the UK, they will have a specific type of subject area that they specialize in. So you might have a language school. And so they'll force every single student to do at least one language as part of their GCSEs. Whereas my school that I went to forced every single student to do business. And that was probably the first formal time I understood what business actually was. And I enjoyed it quite a lot. The other part of it was there was a competition that I took part in called the Stock Market Young Investor Challenge. And this was run by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a large economic/finance think tank in the UK. But the point being is that this was the first time that I got any kind of insight into economics, into financial markets, and into that sort of world that existed. I liked it so much. I was good at it to the point where we used to get A's and did really well in the competition, etc. That I then did economics in my A levels, which is the next, which is the highest tier of education before you do a degree in the UK. Did economics, did really well there, did some maths alongside it as well. Got more, a lot more stuck into it, and just found things clicked a lot more for me because it explained how the world worked around me as well, for better or for worse, for that matter. And then I decided, hey, I wasn't good enough for physics, I tried A-level physics, couldn't do it, dropped it as a subject, decided to double down on maths and economics instead. And so in my mind, it was, you know, do what you're good at, which is, you know, economics. So that's why I pursued that a lot more. I often like to give economics this interesting announcement, which is that it's the, at least in retrospect, I think it's the highest respect degree for the least amount of effort. It's got the perfect ratio there. Whereas if you were to say do law, medicine, any STEM subject, or even any kind of other social science like history, there's a lot of essay writing in history, for example, you know, that's high effort, high respect. I'm being quite lazy. I'm picking, you know, high respect, low effort. So it was a bit of a cheeky one, I suppose, in that sense. But I think economics for me, it explains why things are the way they are. It's about, you know, oh, the world works like this. This is a good thing. It's like, no, these are, you know, the world works in this way because our incentives are this way, because society has decided to set itself off in this way. Oh, and because, oh, we need capitalism because we need to eat and we need to make money and all that kind of stuff as well. So it explains in lots of detail why things are the way they are and why it's so difficult to change them as well. And what drives value, inherently drives value. I mean, if you have five of something, that's quite rare. If you have a million of something, that's not rare at all. And so the value of the thing that is only you have five of is obviously a lot more than the one that you have a million of. So, you know, it's the classic phrase, you know, if money grew on trees, it would be as worthless as leaves, you know, something like that. So they, you had this very nice kind of seamless transition from, you know, doing business and doing competitions in GCSEs to doing A-level economics more formally and then moving properly into an undergraduate degree in that subject area, which combined a lot of these different things around business, around maths, and general curiosity around how people worked. And that's what economics is in a nutshell.
Oh, you did mention that you're enrolling in a competition. How do you build the confidence to do so?
Well, you get confidence by trying. It goes back to what I said before. If you do something for the first time, you will suck at it. That's just how it is. It's very, very unlikely that you will be good at something the first time. And that's not because you know you're bad at it. It's because you haven't trained for it. In fact, ask yourself, you know, the first time that, say, you know, a football player kicks a ball, will they score a fantastic goal? No, they won't. It'll be terrible. But by doing it again and again and again, you get better and better and better. And if you train it enough, then you will become excellent at it. Now, yes, there's a bit of talent involved and things like that. But I really do believe that if you put your mind to something for a long enough period of time, you're guaranteed to get to a very good standard at this. And only the last, say, 5-10% is raw talent, I suppose. But beyond that, you can get really good at lots of different things just by sheer practicing it. And in some things, you'll be really quick and really natural to it. Other things might take a bit of extra time, but you just have to try and see what works. It really is a trial and error thing. So to get confidence, you need to, you know, just put yourself in there and see how it goes. And don't fear failure, you know. Competitions, yeah, they're competitive. That's what competitions are. But, you know, are you going to win every single competition? Well, no, you're not. So it's okay. So you know, go into these competitions, not just with a kind of, I want to win mindset, and that's fine to have, but also go into it and say, well, have I learned anything new from here? Will I gain anything valuable from this experience? And am I pushing myself to learn more? Have those other things as well, you know, because if you win, but you didn't, you know, I could win. Anyone here could win a competition for, you know, primary school students, you know, but what's the point of that? There's no fun. It's no competition. It's too easy. But we do want to win those tough competitions because that's where the more exciting things are. So that's kind of the big thing. I think the other thing with confidence is believe in yourself that you can do it. And that might sound very cliched and very obvious, but I think a lot of people think to themselves, oh, I can't do that. Oh, I'm not good enough. When actually your mindset should really be around, your mindset should really be, of course I can do that. Of course I can do that. You know, so I will do it just to prove a point. I think that's a much more effective way of thinking about things rather than trying to discount yourself and say, no, actually I can be amazing. I will be amazing. Let me try this and prove it to the world. that gets better results, in my opinion. And when I've had that mindset in different things, it might go horribly wrong, but at least I tried. At least I learned something interesting from it. And when it is, when it does go well, amazing. I just proved myself right. I proved myself, proved the world I'm right as well. So, so it just comes down to just pushing yourself in there. A lot of competitions also have teams as well. So if you're not, pair with your friends, do that as well. You know, no shame in that. In fact, it can be a good thing as well, because you'll learn from each other, you'll bounce ideas off as well. So, you don't have to do everything alone. You can do it in teams, you can do it on your own as well. Or you can do kind of easy competitions and build yourself up from that side as well. So, pick a competition that, you're more likely to win or do well in, and then build up from there. So, but you just have to start. You just have to get stuck in.
I couldn't have said better, Faz. Thank you. And I would love to just quote you and repeat what you just said. You said two things first. It's not that you're bad at it, it's that you haven't trained for it. The second thing you said is, will you win each competition? No, you're not. And to understand better what Faz just said, think about the reality of athletes. They are competing, but they are not winning all the time. And we saw it clearly during the Olympics. So if you don't understand what Faz meant through this, watch again your country's involvement in the Olympics. Look at how hard they were working and willing to compete, and knowing that they could potentially win as much as they could potentially lose. But they just went with this mindset on, again, going back to what Faz just said, just, I can do that. I can try. And will I learn something new? What will I gain in terms of experience? Again, to quote Faz, there's so much to gain from that. Going back to your undergrad, Faz, how are your marks? What did you learn from those years?
I was a better student at university, did very well in first year, did okay average in second year, and then did pretty well in my final year as well. I think the key thing for me at university is that university has two aspects to it. You have the degree aspect, so why are you there? You're studying to get a degree out of it. And then you have the other part, which is the experiences part. You are there to develop as a person, because university is the last place where you will have a controlled environment. It is the last place where you will have an environment where you can fail with the safety net. That's what university offers you. Because if you mess up, yes, your parents aren't there. Yes, your family isn't there. Your friends aren't. Maybe your friends are in different places. But the university is designed as a organization and as an institution, shall I say, to support you. So that's from every aspect. That's from housing, from financing, from taking risks and all these different things. That's what a university's job is. It is to cultivate youth and make it not just productive members of society, but, critical thinkers as well. That's the purpose of education. And so, yes, you have your degree. Yes, you should become an expert in that by getting your degree. But you need to explore everything that you can that a university has to offer. And I think that's what my university experience was like. So yeah, I did the assignments. Yeah, I missed a few lectures here and there. Maybe could have studied a bit harder and got a bit of a higher mark or whatever. But I did enough. I did my part there to get the grades that I needed. And then I also prioritized a lot of extracurriculars as well on the side as well. So you have these two aspects of university that you need to consider.
University is designed to support you. Do remember this as you start this new year. Go all in and embrace learnings, failures, whatever you want to call it, and embrace growth. Faz, tell us a little bit more about your own experience. You won awards, you built projects, joined societies, and built even more from the ground up. And you went all in yourself. What did those years teach you?
It taught me I have a lot more time than I think. 24 hours is actually quite a lot of time. And if you know how to use it effectively, you can do a lot of stuff, a lot of stuff. So that's the first thing. So the way in which I think about my university time is that there were kind of four different categories. So you have things that I would do with my department itself. So every single university has a department that will teach you the subject. And so I did a lot of work directly with my department. This included things like volunteering for various experiments. So there were some game theory experiments which I volunteered for. This was helping out with becoming a course representative, which means that I'm a student, but I will represent the entire student class in front of the faculty and in front of the lecturers and professors, so to get their voices heard. There are module representatives as well. So for a particular module, you might be the representative just for that module to make sure that the professor hears the guidance and hears the feedback from the students for that particular class. So I did that as well. Then you have kind of supporting the university at various other things, like you can become a student ambassador, so you can do tours of the university for parents and younger students coming who may be interested in joining that university. So that's kind of the first part, things that are directly with the university itself. Then you've got societies. And this is the most fun part, where societies are fantastic because a good university will have virtually any society of any kind. And if it doesn't exist, you can create your own. And that's the best part about it. So you are using them to find like-minded individuals, people with the same interests as you do, to make friends, to make connections. People I know have got married from, they found people they got married with the society. So it's really, really great stuff that happens in these places. You meet lifelong friends. I have loads of friends that I've met from, I talked to today from these societies as well. And you really understand and really hone in on a particular interest that you have in a lot more detail than you might think, because some of the people in these societies will just be obsessed with something. So, you know, I remember, you know, I went to a blockchain society event once. I knew nothing about blockchain at the time, but the level of detail these guys had was just ridiculous, and it was very interesting to me. I was like, that's actually quite interesting stuff you're looking at. Don't necessarily believe in it, but that's a separate question, I suppose. So that's kind of a really big thing about it. The third part of it is kind of other things like internships, insight days, spring week, summer internships, winter internships, things like that. So anything that can give you a real world experience around what life will look like in a traditional white collar job, that is, I think, essential. And it is best done when you're at university, because you're not going to work in a particular place for the next 40 years or whatever. You can get a quick insight into what types of jobs and what types of careers exist out there. And so, you know, you should be looking at things across industries, across different companies, across different departments inside of companies. So, you know, I did an experience at accountancy firms. I had experiences at an oil and gas company. I had experiences, you know, lots of different insight days at various banks, technology companies, and a bunch of other places as well. And the way in which they do things is very, very different, even in the same industry as well. But also, you know, you might think of, you know, let's say you do a role such as, let's say you become an IT professional. Well, an IT professional in an oil and gas company would be very different from an IT professional in a bank, which is very different to an IT professional in a healthcare company or a pharmaceutical company. So it's the same role, but there's a very different experience and different type there. And you have to talk to people in these industries to understand how things work. There are loads of insight days out there where you can get a 1 or 2 day or even up to a 4 day experience in these different industries as well. I think in the UK, they're called spring weeks most frequently. There are internships that you're typically doing your second or third year. There are placement years where you can spend a full year in a particular company or doing a very interesting role. And these are most of the time these are paid as well. So you'll get money for it as well, which is obviously great to have. Some pocket money for the summer and everything. And all of these things are there to provide you with a perspective of how things work in the real world. You're not there to change things. You're not there to disrupt things. You're there just to learn and see how the world works, and these are fantastic experiences you have to do. And the fourth one and the final one is personal projects. So you've got your university stuff, you've got your society stuff, you've got your corporate stuff, and those three are very structured because you have a defined society structure, you have a defined university structure, you have defined companies that do specific things. The personal projects is where you really shine, because these are things that you yourself are passionate about that you want to do alone, typically alone. It can be with a few friends. But these are things that you have complete control over from start to finish. So if it gets done, it's on you. If it doesn't get done, it's on you as well. Nobody's there to check it. Nobody's there to tell you off. either you do it or you don't. And I think that's where you really generate the most amount of experience and most amount of maturity when it comes to your university time. So I spent a lot of time doing things like I created a conference company to kind of run events for the different things. It was called the York Science Conference. There was I won a few awards for something called the Proof of Concept Award, where I developed a student incubator for students who had entrepreneurial ideas. You know, there were other things as well. So, you know, there was a student investment club, which I was a part of as well, which had a lot of good fun. We were investing about £10,000 of university money, real money that we could just play around in the stock market. Had to get a lot of fun there as well. It was things like that, which pushed me way further than any degree could teach me or any kind of society could teach me, because I had to do everything myself. And so try and do all of these different things, because when you leave university, you want to look back and say, I used that time, those 3 or 4 years, to its absolute fullest. I got the degree, yes. I got the marks I wanted, but I also made great friends. I've got lifelong contacts with the university. I've made societies, created a nice culture and nice community inside the university. I got some work experience, got a bit of money as well. I learned how the real world works. And, you know, I have my own personal project as well that I'm doing side on too. So try and do as much as you can as possible. You can do it. I think a lot of people think they can't. You can do it. And just try to use your time there to become a more formative person overall. That's the big takeaway from that.
You do have a lot of time, and absolutely agreed, use it wisely. Parallel engagements will teach you more than classes would. And societies are a goldmine. They're such an interesting opportunity. Use them, the funds offered by the university, to find like-minded people, to make friends. Build the society that you need if you don't find one that aligns with your interests, values, passions, anything. Thanks, Faz, for sharing. And looking back at everything you did and shared, what are the things that you would not do again, and the things that you would do again? For sure,
there's nothing that I wouldn't do again. I'm genuinely serious about that, because there is so many interesting things that you can do at university that I think, even if you don't necessarily like it that much, that I still think the experience is worthwhile just to have and have it for your own eyes. I mean, a good example of this is that I attended a debate society event once, and I thought it was really interesting. I wouldn't go back again personally, but I thought it was a good experience. The people were very nice, despite being in the actual debate itself, which was good humor and everything. But I think it was I wouldn't change anything. I would do everything again, to be honest. I think what was interesting for me was, is there enough variety in what I'm doing? So, you know, there's a society that's typically called Model United Nations. I would strongly recommend anyone of any subject do that. Not because you don't have to have a particular interest in politics or diplomacy or international relations, but they have a very specific way of doing things, which is that you'll be given a brief on a particular country and topic area. And then on the big screen of the projector, they'll give you 30 seconds to say your piece. And if you don't finish in that 30 seconds, they literally take the mic away from you, or they start smacking the gavel on the thing saying, no, 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 you can't do that whatsoever. Shut up, sit down. It forces you to think on your feet and to be very precise in what you're saying, because you only have 30 seconds, maybe a minute. If you're really lucky, maybe a minute and a half or 2 minutes even. But you have to be very precise in what you're saying, and you have to be very clear about what types of things and types of points you want to raise. That is probably the best thing you can do for your public speaking and for your personal confidence. Because although everyone stares at you, you get that fear out of you the more and more you do it, and you will get picked on. So you might as well go there and you might as well enjoy it while you're at it. Because at the end of the day, no one cares that much. They really don't after the event closes. So just try it, see what happens, and go on from that side. I think so that's kind of so for me, it was getting a variety of experiences that matched the most. I think for me, societies were really enjoyable because you were meeting people who you knew were already interested in that area. So you didn't have to second guess yourself. You're like, oh, why are you here? You know, let's say you like Pokemon. Why are you here? I like Pokemon as well. Great. You know, it's an easy conversation starter, or just like that. You know, if you go to the Lego Society, you know, I was like, oh, I like Lego, you like Lego. Okay, great. Now let's have a 5-hour conversation about Lego pieces. You know, whatever. Let's nerd out. It's great. So, you know, that might not be your choice, but there'll definitely be something there. And that's the beauty of societies. And you know, I love the point that you mentioned. You know, if you don't see a society that exists, make it yourself, because I honestly guarantee you there will be at least 5 other people around who will join you, I mean, and have fun with it. We had a Taylor Swift society. I don't listen to Taylor Swift, but that society was very popular, naturally, and good for them. Great, you know, all the Swifties are over there having a lot of fun. You know, we had the hat society. People wore different hats. Why not? Little things like that, they can be silly, they can be fun, they can be whatever you want. It's just about finding people of interest, finding people that you can get along with, and just getting as many new experiences as possible by talking to people, by doing interesting things, and by doing it in a safe and reliable format. That's why it was all so good. I think for me, the corporate experiences, they are very structured, but the purpose of the corporate experiences is to give you a realistic view on what's going to happen. So you need to have both. So you have your societies where you're a free spirit, you can do whatever you want, have all the fun you like. You have your internships and things where you're supposed to wear your suit and tie, supposed to do the job properly it's assigned to you, and you have these two different worlds entirely, and you need to find where you fit in that balance. Some people I know love the structure. They want a corporate job because they like the stability, they like the money, they like the fact that it's very predictable and that brings ease to that. That's absolutely fine. Other people like to go absolutely crazy. They want to go full society mode, so they'll become artists, musicians. These are the kind of your creative types, and for them it's all about expressing themselves, producing fascinating, interesting culture, literature, music, art, etc. That's great for them as well. You might be somewhere in the middle between those two extremes, and that's also good as well. So you have to get both experiences so you can find which part of it, which way you lean more. I probably, when I was younger, probably lead a bit more to the corporate side of stuff, but as time has gone on, I probably lead a bit more over to the more creative side over time. So, you know, you have to do both, and they're both complementary, and I wouldn't say that they're not mutually exclusive. You have to do both to get a bigger picture and a wider picture of how the world works.
Oh, that's so interesting. And Model UN is an absolute fantastic experience. You need to be precise, clear on what you're saying, and such a great exercise for public speaking. Even if you have the fear of speaking in front of hundreds of people, or just 5 people or 2 people, I think you just get to understand that everybody's scared, everybody's confused, no one has the confidence. But as Fast said, and other guests have said, you gain the confidence from doing, so go for it. Maturity, consistency, commitment. You do need so much to start building your own thing. But where do you start to build it? You mentioned the conference project you had. What advice would you give someone who thinks about moving forward with their own project?
So at my university, I went to the University of York. And in my first year, there were a variety of student-run conferences in different areas. So there was the York Finance Conference, the York Consulting Conference, even a York Law Conference. And all of these conferences were student-run. They were very successful. And I was looking around at this and thinking, is there a science or technology conference? And the answer was no. And so I was like, okay, let me just do it myself, because clearly there's no interest in this. Let's see what happens. So that was the first point of inspiration where I saw that there was a gap in the market, and I thought, hey, I don't study a STEM subject, I study economics, but you know, I do have a genuine interest in science and technology, so why not, you know, create one? And it was a very simple start. It didn't cost me anything. I created a Facebook page, and I put a couple of job ads on that. I created a nice job description saying, I need people to help me on marketing, finance, operations, speakers, etc. If you're interested, fill in this Google form, and I'll get back to you. And I put that across all the different society Facebook groups that existed. I don't know if Facebook is still used as much nowadays, but that's how I worked back then, at least. And I just spammed it everywhere on departments. I even went to departments. I said, hey, I am creating a science conference. I would like students to help me on this. Please, can you put it into your weekly newsletter so people can read it and come to me? Can I go into a lecture hall? Well, I would email a professor and say, hey, can I go to your lecture for the first literally 30 seconds? Just make a quick announcement and asking if anybody wants to be part of my team, then, you know, scan this QR code that I have on the front desk and you know, reach out to me at my email. That was very successful to the point where I got about 10 or so people to respond to those ads to build out my first team. And that first team was very, very good. They knew exactly what they were doing. And the point I'm making here is that it didn't cost me anything to put those Facebook ads up or posts up. It didn't cost anything to go to the various departments and ask them to put it into a student newsletter. It didn't cost anything to go up to a lecturer and say, hey, can I do a lecture shout out or something? It just took a bit of grit and a bit of time. That's all it was. And a bit of creativity, you know, but it didn't cost me anything financially. And that's kind of how it started. Once I got the team sorted, then it became very easy to actually do what a conference is, which is all the classical things, such as, you know, you need to find speakers, a venue, get some catering, and all the things that go alongside of it, right? I think the thing for me is that the interesting thing about it was that there was a level of naivety that I had, which is that I didn't even know what I didn't know. And so, you know, I had this level of confidence that I just did things without actually thinking about the consequences, and I got very good results from it. Whereas if I had a bit more information about how the university worked, I probably would have thought a second time. But the fact is, I think what that taught me is that you need to ask for forgiveness, not permission at times, because you get much better results. Whereas, you know, if you always ask for permission, you have people will always, put it this way, people always will always have an excuse to shut you down. It's very easy to critique. It's very difficult to do. And so, you know, in my mind, it was just, I'm a non-STEM student going up to a STEM department and saying, hey, I want to build an event. Can you help me? And they're looking at me and says, why not? Let's help them out. I mean, some departments said, oh, go away. You're a go away city child. You know, I don't want to interact with you. But most of the departments there were very supportive. And we had some really nice interactions with different lecturers, professors who were genuinely really supportive for our cause, which was great to see. So that's kind of how it kind of got started. And then bit by bit, month by month, we kind of worked on it as a team together. We found the speakers, we found the venue, you know, we found sponsors, we developed a website, we got, you know, we did all the kind of things that you expect to do. And a lot of this stuff is already out there on Google. You can quickly search for it and stuff. It's just a matter of doing the actual work. There is no shortage of advice out there, but the biggest problem people have is no one actually applies the advice that gets given to them. If you actually apply advice that's given to you, the outcomes you get are so much better. I would check Google and say, hey, you know, I want to make money from this. How do I do this? And they said, okay, well, you need to find sponsors. Okay, well, how do I find sponsors? Okay, well, you need to create a sponsorship deck. Okay, well, how do you do that? Here's a template. Fill it out with your own information. Okay, well, I did that as well. And I kind of went every single step of the way. I kind of asked myself again and again, what things do I need to do to get these things done? And when I did that, and when I did all the action, then I got some good results. So I had a sponsorship pack. I had some good marketing, good socials out there. I had a couple of companies even reached out to me and said, hey, we want a sponsor. Great. Happily. I'm happy to take our money from you. So yeah, we got about £500 plus from one sponsor. The university itself sponsored us with another £500. We had a few departments sponsored us as well with a couple of £100 here and there. We had a whole host of companies arrive, and it was honestly magical. It was honestly impressive for the first event to get that many companies of one single place of that variety as well, where you had everyone from aerospace companies to governmental bodies such as, you know, the Royal Society of Chemistry, Institute of Physics, things like that. You had, you know, government departments themselves like Ferroscience and others. You had private corporations. So we had a speaker from Amazon Web Services arrive from California, which was great to see. It was a truly crazy time. My grades suffered a bit of it. Actually, in fact, to the point where my grades actually suffered quite a bit of it. I probably could have got a much higher mark. If I didn't have the conference, I would have got a first in my second year, but I didn't because, you know, it's the time where there wasn't enough time to study, basically. But I don't regret it at any point because there were so many things I learned, so many mistakes made, and I had to do everything from interviewing candidates for the roles, to putting the adverts up, to doing the social media, to doing, to finding a venue for free, to managing sponsors and relationships, all the little things that all that have are still serving me today, almost 5+ years later. So that's why it was such a fantastic experience. And it all started from just seeing a very obvious problem, which was, oh, there's a finance and law conference. Why isn't there a science one? And it started from there.
Don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness is something I absolutely live by for professional projects. And so just go for it. Because if you wait for advice, feedback before starting, it might prevent you from moving forward because people will have a very limited understanding of what you mean, your idea, your ambitions, and it can be due to so many different reasons. So the idea is that just go, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness, and you'll see what happens. And thank you for your transparency on your grades, Faz. If you want to do a lot, if you have to do a lot because you have to work part-time to finance your study or any other activity, you will have to make concessions and it might impact your grade. If you make everything happen, that's absolutely amazing. But my advice to you is to ask people who have graduated from your program or are in a position you're aiming for or surrounding you, what you should prioritize and where you should invest more of your time. I just want you to know that's incredibly challenging to find the first job you're interested in without having a minimum of experience, whether it's internship or a part-time job in a professionalizing space. And to almost wrap up on your university years, Faz, what advice do you have for first-year students or someone going through their undergrad as we speak?
Ooh, so my advice does change depending on at what stage of university you're at. So if you're about to start or you're even in your first year, do everything you can. Genuinely, there's no shortcut to this. You have to participate in as many activities as possible, especially if you're in your first year, because that's when you have the most amount of time. I mean, most people in my year, we got first class degrees in our first year with very little ease. You know, it was very easy to get those high marks because a lot of the information that we had was studying were just from our A level exams. And so for us, we had loads of spare time to not study but spend time on societies and other things. And that's the best time to do it because lots of universities, first year doesn't count at all to your overall degree, or it counts to a very small portion of it, like 10%, 20% max. And so that's the time to do it. So if you're about to start university or you're in your first year, do absolutely everything you can to maximize the time you're spending on campus and getting involved in as many activities as possible. If you're in second year or third, or like a middle year, penultimate year, something like that, it is, you can still do a lot of different things. I think at that point, you need to be a little bit more targeted. So you can't just do anything you want. You need to be a bit more specific in terms of going for committee roles specifically. So in first year, I would just do kind of a general explorative mode. In second year, you need to be on committee positions because that's where you get actual experience and you need to do a good job of it as well. So you need to be on the committee that grew your society membership by 100 people, that you got money, you got over £100 of sponsorship by the department or from various companies of interest or things like that. You need to be doing really well in that regard. You need to have growth in social media and really fancy events people are going to, et cetera, et cetera. Like that's what your job needs to be done. You need to be facilitating this and being the hands-on people doing this work. So you go from being an attendee to the events to being a supporting organizer. In final year, you should really be president of at least one society, or at least vice president, a bare minimum. You know, you have to, you need to be in a leadership position. You can do it in first and second year as well, but in third year, it's almost essential to have this. And so if you're going into if you're going into your final year, then find a leadership position that you can take on in existing society and try your best in that world and show leadership qualities in that sense. It's a bit too late to start a society in the final year, in my opinion. I tried that with one thing. COVID didn't help, but it was very difficult. So by the time we started, although we started it in September, we didn't actually get it off the ground until January, until after our winter exams. And at that point, COVID hit. And so we kind of, and then it was after that exams had come around. And so you don't actually get that much time. Most of the society work happens over the summer during the breaks. Well, that's where the most amount of impact comes through, because you're able to get new students involved. You're able to do a lot of the groundwork that will set you up for success the following academic year. So that's kind of on the society side. I think the other part of it is your job as a student is to demonstrate credibility in your skill set. So you might be a programming genius, but if you don't have any proof of this, nobody cares, respectfully. So if you are doing lots of interesting things, or if you have a very good skill set, you need to have a portfolio of some kind where you are doing interesting projects, where you have outputs of this. The easiest way to start this is by taking your dissertation and making it into blog posts. That's actually the easiest way to do this, because all of a sudden because you should be an expert in your particular area when you have a degree. That's what a degree is for. And so that's, if you're literally struggling for nothing, try that as your first port of call. Make blog posts out of your dissertation or your thesis. I think other than that, there isn't really much else you can do. You can apply for jobs, you can, you know, do some internships here and there, but it really comes down to skill learning and skill development and credibility. And these both go hand in hand. And if you can't get one or both, then my hot take on this is you probably didn't use your time effectively at university. And so there's not much you can do behind that, unless you were to do a bunch of personal projects that would support this down the line, or you were to do a master's or do another degree, essentially. So that's kind of the reality I think that people really need to hear when it comes to university life and experiences. The only thing I'd add to this is, I live in the UK. I think I'm very well aware that, you know, you have things like cost of living crisis, and you have things where these opportunities are not as readily available because you just can't afford to do it. So you have to then work a part-time job, for example. Or, you know, you need to, or you might have other responsibilities, like caring responsibilities, that you have to go back home to take care of people. There are realities of life that can get in the way of these things. That said, these things you can change into a strength. They don't have to be weaknesses. So if you are working part-time in a retail job, that itself can be used as a strength, because you have punctuality, timekeeping, you need to be working in a team, if working in, say, McDonald's is a very stressful environment, actually. People make it a joke, but actually it's a very demanding job at times. And so I do have a lot of respect for people who are in those environments, particularly young people and students who don't really have any other choice at times. If you have caring responsibilities, again, it's a very noble thing to do that, and you can make it into a strength. So don't make excuses, because even if you're in a situation where things are not that great for you, you can still demonstrate those skills and provide a rational story for why you got that point. And if you can just do one thing, one society really well, that can be enough to tip you over the edge and give you that extra boost that you need. So while it's great to do as many things as possible, and at least when I was at university, it was a lot easier to do a lot more things. Even if you can't do all, you know, 10 different things, if you just do one or two, that goes a long way over doing literally nothing.
So the takeaway here is, whether you're doing your part-time job because you have to pay your rent, your utilities, and feed yourself, or you have plenty of time but you have not yet started to do something in parallel to your studies, try to do something. Do something, and if you're doing something, try to identify what kind of skills you're developing and what you will be able to present to a job interview, or what are you going to bring to the table if you need to build your own thing.
So wrapping up those very important years,
so Faz, what did you do after uni?
So my first job straight out of university was in Dublin, in Ireland. So I moved abroad from the UK to Ireland. So, but for me, it was just great to leave the country, and just particularly when I was that young, you know, I'm 21, I'm in a new place. Why not just experience, you know, the world in a different place and just get, you know, there's no support network, completely brand new place to me. I can't run to my parents. There's no, my sisters aren't around, you know, there's no cousins or extended family I can look to. And, you know, the closest way to get there is by plane or like a ferry on a very long train journey. So, okay, you have to push yourself to a new limit. So I think that's kind of what happened there. So my expectation was to join the finance sector after I graduated. But that didn't happen for various reasons. I graduated in COVID, et cetera, things like that. So I was like, hey, why not try something different? I'd created a science conference. I have always been interested in STEM and computer science, things like that. So why not look at the tech sector as well? And so I found a job at then Facebook, now Meta. That was in their risk management and intelligence team, where you were analyzing social media trends and you were coming up with solutions to very difficult problems.
And what did you learn during your time there? Did you have any mentors, sponsors, someone who coached you?
Yeah, well, loads. I think it was, I don't think I could have asked for a better first job, mostly because it structured my thinking in a much better way. I'll give you an example. So Meta's whole thing is impact. There is an obsession with doing impactful things. And that is the most important thing to the company. And it is the most important thing, I think, that for any company should really have. Other companies might focus on the hours you're working. They might focus on how many days you're in the office. They might focus on, you know, very trivial, tiny little things like this. And that, or how many emails you're sending, how many messages you're sending. These are not impactful things inherently. What is impactful is, did you do a particular task that led to, that helped the company achieve a particular aim? So if you're in sales, are you making more money for the company? Or if you're in operations, are you making things more efficient and smoother for everybody? If you're in a leadership position, are you inspiring your team and motivating them and hiring the best people around? You know, these are the things that drive impact. And Meta is very good at explaining this to its people, in my opinion. And it's very good at driving this into your head that it's impact that matters, not these tiny things. You know, oh, how many hours have you worked? Oh, I worked 2 hours. But if those 2 hours, I made the company $1 billion. Great, who cares? Because that's what matters the most. It's about the impact and the metrics behind it, rather than the vanity stuff that exists. So that was the biggest thing that I learned from my time there. In terms of kind of mentors and sponsored things like that, I think I think the key thing about this first job is, like, because it's your first job, you have a clean slate. So although I did internships and things like that, I think I was looking at it from a very corporate lens, from the banking side, the currency world, things like that, where I'm looking at it and saying, oh, you know, your logos need to be at exactly this dimension in this particular corner of a slide or whatever. Or, you know, you cannot use Excel without a mouse. This is a, you know, a cardinal sin or whatever. So I'm looking at it from that perspective, and I kind of see, oh, okay, actually the world is not that stuffy and not that, you know, crazy. You can do things, you can use a mouse with Excel if you want to. You know, you can leave the office at 3 p.m. as long as you do your work and get everything done. And this is okay. You can have a life. So I think that was kind of the good thing that I experienced, which is it changed my perspective in terms of what really matters here. I kind of expand on that as well. So a lot of students will have a particular ambition. They might say, oh, I want to become famous. I want to become an entrepreneur. And on the surface, I understand where these things come from, but you're looking at it the wrong way. The aim shouldn't be to get the label, to become an entrepreneur, to become famous. The aim should be to do something so interesting that people look at you enough to make you famous. The thing should be you produce a good or service that's so useful and so valuable that people make you an entrepreneur because of that. That's what is that's what Mela taught me around. I said, don't focus on the hours you're working. Don't focus on the number of times you're in the office. Focus on what you're actually doing behind the scenes and what's the actual impact behind it. So ask yourself whenever you're doing a task, what is the impact of this particular activity? Have I helped people? Have I got money for my society? Have I grown my social media accounts? Have I, got more events? Have I inspired a generation of children and students to do some particular thing? Have I improved the prestige of the university that I'm at via the event I'm hosting? These are the things that drive impact and what you should be focusing on.
And to wrap up on this episode, Faz, do you have any last advice? I know you shared so many throughout, but do you have any last advice for our listeners?
Oh, such a hard question. I'll go back to what I said initially when I talked about success. So I said at the beginning, don't ask what you want, ask why you want it. So to kind of expand upon that a bit more, you know, ask yourself, you know, what generates the most impact? What generates the most amount of fulfillment and contentment? Because that's where all this matters. That's where this matters. It's fine to have all these accolades. It's fine to, you know, do crazy things and have fun. And yeah, and you should have fun. You should enjoy your things of doing it. But you should be asking yourself, you know, you should be doing this because you want to live an interesting and fulfilling life. And that's where all this comes down to. There's so much knowledge in the world. There's so many things to see and do. And you are only barely scratching the surface and you'll never have enough time to see everything. So you might as well just try your best and see as much as you can. Talk to people, learn from people, try things, try as many things as possible, because something will stick. Something will stick. And when it does, you'll find a true, something you're good at. And when you're good at something, you'll actually enjoy doing it and you'll become better at it. And then, yeah, you can make money from it. You can create a business from it or whatever. But I think just constantly ask yourself, is this useful? Is this impactful? And is this helping my community? Is this helping, you know, my soul? And do I feel more fulfilled from doing this work? And this is not just monetary. This is in every aspect of life. So don't just ask what you want, ask why you want it.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Faz, for everything that you shared so far with us and for your brilliant advice to close this conversation. So thank you again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.